Hello, my name's Marcus Speller from the Football Ramble, and welcome to the Mixer Podcast. This is the first episode in an eight-part series to coincide with the release of The Mixer, a book written by one of our panellists, Michael Cox, to coincide with the Premier League's 25th season. The book charts the story of Premier League tactics over that period, from Route 1 to False Nines, out now, of course, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. And Michael will be joining me in each episode. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Marcus.
Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
I mean, it's quite crucial because it is your book, of course.
Yeah, it's handy. It's handy.
Well, every episode we'll be joined by another guest in something of a squad rotation system, if you will. Today we're joined by Tom Williams, who is the London sports correspondent for AFP, the French equivalent of the Press Association. He's had a Glenn Hoddle-esque spell in France, if you will, before returning to Britain. Now spends his time travelling up and down the country covering Premier League games. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Marcus.
Lovely to have you here as well.
Thank you for having me.
So then, Michael, you've written this book. You must be fairly well equipped with some in-depth Premier League knowledge by now.
Yeah, I've spent a year essentially just watching old Premier League games and reading often very tedious autobiographies of former Premier League stars. You'd be surprised how many players have autobiographies that have kind of been lost to the wilderness, apart from on kind of Amazon secondhand section. So a lot of useless knowledge. Yeah.
Well, what's the most obscure tale you've got for us from some of these perhaps tedious books or your own findings?
Most obscure, or one of my favourite tales, is the fact that when Gianfranco Zola arrived at Chelsea, he was so astonished by how poor the equipment was at Chelsea's training ground, and he wanted to practice free kicks.
Yeah.
And so he ended up buying his own mock defensive wall, had it delivered to Chelsea's training ground, and spent the morning assembling it, and then would stay behind after training every day to practice. But that's quite how bad things were in the early days of the Premier League era for Chelsea. Players had to buy their own mock defensive wall. It worked because he scored the joint most free kicks in Premier League history alongside one David Beckham.
That is incredible, isn't it? I remember Fabrizio Ravanelli, when he went to Middlesbrough, apparently there was no training in the afternoon. He couldn't believe it. So he used to fax back, as it was in those days, although football clubs do like a fax machine. And he would need to get more training drills sent to Middlesbrough for him because he felt this was just, it was a part-time job almost. He couldn't believe it, you know. Incredible.
But that's the interesting thing about Ian Wright always says, that when he had that trial at Palace, but he was amazed the players just went home at lunchtime. And he said he got so good because he was used to being on a building site and just stay behind and practice.
Absolutely.
A man you know well, of course. I don't need to tell Ian Wright stories.
But I'm sure some of the listeners may not, but always worth a mention for Ian Wright. Well, each episode of this podcast is themed according to a certain position. We'll be discussing the evolution of various roles in a football side over the course of the Premier League's 25 years. And for episode number one, we're talking about number ones, the goalkeepers. Michael, it was a fundamental change to goalkeeping, which essentially marked the start of the Premier League era, you'd say.
Yeah, well, everyone talks about how football didn't begin in 1992 because of the Premier League era, but what did happen in 1992 was the back pass change. Yes. And if you go back and you look at one of the games from Euro 92, any of the games, but particularly the final when Denmark beat Germany 2-0, the extent to which Denmark time-wasted in that game by just knocking the ball around at the back and passing it back to Schmeichel. There's one incident in the closing minutes where one of the Danish forwards dribbles over the halfway line, is fouled, dusts himself down, turns around and fires the free kick 60 yards back to Schmeichel. He picks it up, and they just did this the whole game. And the fact that goalkeepers could no longer do that meant they had to become comfortable in possession. Defenders had to become comfortable in possession. The game quickened. It just became a more entertaining game. And I think that, as much as the start of the Premier League era, is why 1992, for all of Europe, well, all of the world, is quite a crucial cut-off point.
We forget about the revolutionary back pass rule. You know, it's so standard these days, but what a difference it's made to the game, really. Tom, would you say that Peter Schmeichel is still the best goalkeeper of the Premier League era?
I think so. I think on the one hand, you've got the fact that he was a stupendous goalkeeper, very successful, won everything possible, really, with Manchester United. But also, he was a real goalkeeping revolutionary. His background had been in handball, and so you mentioned the starfish save earlier on, that was his trademark, that you now see so many goalkeepers incorporate into their technique as goalkeepers. That wasn't something that we'd seen to quite the same extent. And I think in this country, there are a lot of sort of hang-ups about goalkeepers that you can sort of trace back to the school playground, almost, like the fat kid who gets picked last, or the little chubby guy who's no good, I'll stick him in goal. And Schmeichel showed that being a goalkeeper didn't mean being this sort of, timorous figure, quivering on the goal line, mm-hmm. waiting for the ball to come to you. He was a very aggressive goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. I mean, he described himself in his early days at Manchester United as a very wild goalkeeper, because he felt that if the ball was in the penalty area, anywhere within the penalty area, he was within his rights to go and claim it.
And he was quite an exciting player to watch, therefore.
Yeah, well, very dynamic. I mean, I remember one of my favourite saves of all time was a Peter Schmeichel double save. United were playing away at Everton in, I think, the 93-94 season, possibly the season before. And he blocks a shot, I think, from Preki. Doesn't block it all too well, and the ball sort of bounces out to the edge of the box. Someone comes in for a follow-up shot, possibly Graeme Stewart. I should have checked who all these people were before I decided to talk about this.
I'm going to question you on that.
And whoever this guy is winds up a shot, and as he's sort of like cocking his leg to shoot, Schmeichel is upon him, leaping, you know, 3 or 4 yards off the ground, full-on starfish, and the ball leaves the Everton player's foot, and within about 2 yards, it struck Schmeichel's chest and ricocheted out for a throw-in. And no sooner had he made the first spot, he was just sprinting out. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we'd seen that in this country, a goalkeeper who was so aggressive and employing those techniques that he'd taken from handball, you know, about making yourself big. And you see, you know, a lot of goalkeepers, you know, Joe Hart is someone who I've seen make a lot of saves like that. Kasper Schmeichel, you would expect that, being Peter Schmeichel's son.
Of course.
Jordan Pickford is another one. I mean, I think these are guys who will have seen Schmeichel during their, you know, early years as football fans, and have incorporated that into their own game.
Yeah, he was one of the stars of those great Manchester United sides in the 90s under Alex Ferguson, of course. And Michael, he, as Tom said, for a goalkeeper to be one of those players to take centre stage was maybe quite a new thing for some football fans, wasn't it, in England?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I think back to Schmeichel, I think as much about his distribution as anything else. Mm. Really long overarm throws, and the way United played with Giggs and Kanchelskis on the flanks.
Oh, yeah.
He was the first attacker. He was almost a playmaker in that role.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even the fact that he, you know, maybe this is just the kind of age I am, but I'd never seen a goalkeeper go downfield to challenge for corners in the last minute if a team were losing.
Yeah, well, right, same for me.
And now it's fairly standard. Like, if a team are losing, you think, is the keeper going to come up?
Yeah.
And probably most of the time they do. Mm-hmm. And of course, he scored against Rota Volgograd in the UEFA Cup.
That's right, yeah.
And I remember he scored, in inverted commas, against Wimbledon in a cup game, I think.
It was. I think it was a cup game away at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
But he was offside.
And a heck of a goal.
Yeah, like an
really,
overhead
really
kick.
Sort of weird, like you know, scissors volley.
But was it was ruled out for offside.
For offside, yeah.
A goalkeeper scoring a goal being ruled out for offside. What on earth? It's remarkable.
And I think it's probably fair to say, I mean, these days we're used to having amongst the best players in the world in the Premier League. But in the first season, he was probably the only player in the Premier League who could have a genuine claim to being the best in his position in the world. And I think that was quite a novelty at the time. We weren't used to players of that calibre.
But he'd found that form at Manchester United, though. Mm-hmm. Obviously he was a decent keeper, hence they signed him. But he wasn't a superstar that came in. Mm-hmm. He became a superstar when he was playing in England as well. Also, you mentioned his red nose earlier. I mean, when he used to bark at the defence, there was a guy who would take charge. And no matter who had the captain's armband, Schmeichel was like another captain on the pitch, Tom.
Yeah, very much so. And he had that natural authority. And it's interesting, I mean, Roy Keane spoke about this a little while ago, and he said that he basically thought it was absolute nonsense, Schmeichel bawling at his defenders. And it tended to be the case that the more spectacular the save he'd made, the louder he'd shout at people. And I think part of it was showmanship. I think part of it was how he motivated himself. And Roy Keane's complaint was that it was if he was saying, oh, you know, look what I'm having to deal with. Look at the fires I'm having to put out because of, you know, these guys in front of me not doing their job properly. And Schmeichel himself has spoken about how important the psychological element was in his approach to goalkeeping. That idea of getting in the striker's head, of being this slightly maniacal figure, flying around the box, charging out for crosses, big starfish saves in one-on-ones. And he wanted every opponent to know that that was his penalty area. And I think the bawling and the screaming at his defenders, I think that was all part of it.
Yeah, very true. One of his, I suppose, if you were call a goalkeeping rival in the 1990s who had a similar kind of stature, was a household name as well, was the Arsenal keeper, David Seaman, Michael. The famous ponytail, the moustache and all. But when I think David Seaman, I think penalty saves.
Yes.
A great penalty stopper for England and for Arsenal as well.
Yeah, I remember him at the time talking about how he had a formula based upon the, I think it was based upon the player's hip position about exactly where they were going to shoot. There was a game against Sampdoria in the Cup Winners' Cup where that's I think right he saved three, mm-hmm, Euro 96. Obviously, he made a couple of crucial
although
stops.
The German player's hips clearly lied to him that night. Because it's always exempt, isn't it, when Germany penalty shoot, that's a concern.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think the interesting thing with Schmeichel and Seaman was that they were kind of complete opposites. I mean, Seaman was very calm, very placid. Mm-hmm. I think in certain respects he was better than Schmeichel. I think his positioning was probably better than Schmeichel.
It was a bold claim.
He never really made spectacular saves, Seaman.
True.
He was the kind of player. I mean, Schmeichel, actually going through looking at the videos, I'd kind of forgotten that Schmeichel actually made quite a lot of mistakes, often with kicking, often with just really strange things you wouldn't expect from a goalkeeper of his calibre. Mm. Seaman, until the end of his career, didn't really make that many mistakes, but he was kind of solid. He wouldn't make the spectacular saves that Schmeichel would.
You wouldn't describe him as agile?
No, but I think his positioning was absolutely mm-hmm fantastic.
Yeah, and towards the end of his career, he did make a few mistakes, but he went on very long. And a save that I can remember quite late on his career was that save against Sheffield United in the semi-final where he had that reach. And Seaman did that a couple of times. There was a save against Scotland where it looked, for all intents and purposes, it was going in, and that big arm of his almost scoops the ball away from the line to safety, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were to criticise Seaman, I think he'd occasionally be a little bit flat-footed. He had that, you know, there were an unfortunate number of times he was lobbed. I mean, and again, I mean, like the Naeem goal.
Arsenal fans won't thank you for saying that.
But I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, you look at those goals. I mean, I don't think he could have done anything about the Naeem goal. I don't think he could have done anything about the Ronaldinho goal. But those were the sort of things that we mm-hmm associated Seaman with. I think his kicking was pretty good for a goalkeeper at that time, and certainly better than Schmeichel's. Mm-hmm. I think he was more comfortable, you know, pinging the ball around to, you know, to members of his back four. But yeah, I mean, you know, fantastic reflexes. I think perhaps shots down around his feet he, you know, perhaps wasn't as comfortable with, but certainly anything that depended on reflexes as the save from, you know, from Paul Pesky Solido demonstrated. Although I do have slightly controversial opinion about great saves, which uh-huh is, I think, basically any goalkeeper in the world, any top goalkeeper, could make any of the great saves. The difference is just finding yourself in that position.
Which goes to what Michael said about Seaman's positioning.
Mm. Yeah.
It's so utterly crucial. And I understand what you mean, because often some keepers are described as great shot stoppers, but suggest that they're not solid, to use that word that we often talk about with goalkeepers, Michael.
Yeah. Well, I understand what Tom means. The ball has to be in a certain place for it to be a great save. If it's a little bit closer to you, then it's just a standard save. Yeah,
sure.
I completely understand what you mean.
Mm. And with those two keepers, Schmeichel and Seaman, both, you know, stalwarts for their clubs and countries, both clubs struggle to replace them, really, which is often a sign of a good goalkeeper and shows the longevity, Tom. Because, I mean, Schmeichel, we know Manchester United took a while, and it was not until really Van der Sar came along. And you could even argue that Arsenal never properly replaced someone like David Seaman in that side. You know, Arsene Wenger's goalkeeper woes have been quite long and protracted, you know, perhaps until Petr Cech came along.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Arsenal since Seaman, you know, they didn't have anyone in the same bracket until Cech came in. And, you know, they got Cech at a very good time. And I don't think he's quite been worth the 15 extra points a season that John Terry said he would be when he left. But I think, you know, from a psychological perspective, there is no longer this thought of, you know, oh, you know, what's the keeper doing? You know, like, can we afford to, you know, to be letting the opponents, you know, even having speculative shots from 25 yards? Whereas if you've got a top goalkeeper like David Seaman or Petr Cech, mm-hmm, you know that, you know, you're going to be okay in that respect. And yeah, I mean, Man United after Schmeichel, it was, you know, all sorts of hapless goalkeepers. You had Bosnic, Massimo Taibbi, you know, the ill-fated Barthez. I mean, and Barthez was actually looked initially as if he might end up being a long-term successor to Schmeichel. And he was a slightly erratic goalkeeper, mm-hmm, with a very unique skill set. This huge booming kick that he had, extremely agile, was someone who, you know, would command his penalty area very well, also took a lot of risks, and as his United career went on, he became more and more error-prone and looked less and less like the great goalkeeper he'd seen when he first arrived. You had the Tim Howard, Roy Carroll phase. Thomas Kuschak came in for a little bit. And towards the end of this period, Edwin van der Sar's playing in goal for Fulham.
Which is remarkable to think.
You know, I think he went straight to Fulham from Juventus,
he
didn't
did,
he?
Yeah.
It's very curious sort of mid-career hiatus and then returns to Man United and becomes one of the best goalkeepers in Europe again.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about van der Sar was everyone kind of thinks, hang on, what was he doing at Fulham? But he'd had such a bad spell at Juventus. Mm-hmm. And I remember that summer, quite a lot of top European clubs were looking for a goalkeeper and bought goalkeepers. But he was playing so badly that no one really wanted him. And so he had this really weird career where his peaks were kind of 95 with that classic Ajax side. And then 2008, 2009. And I'd say even up until 2011 when he retired, he was outstanding that season. Mm. His last season to go out as one of the best in your position in Europe at the age of, I think, 39 by that point, was absolutely incredible.
I mean, his last game was a Champions League final, wasn't it?
Yes, which was unfortunate because he... I wouldn't say he made mistakes for the goals, but it wasn't a grand way to go out.
Yeah, I mean, there was one goal, I think, when Messi scored for the second. He might have done a bit better, but overcoming Pep Guardiola's Barcelona in those days was never an easy feat. Mentioning some of those Manchester United goalkeepers, poor old Massimo Taibbi. He would never be remembered fondly in this country. Well, he might do by Liverpool and Manchester City fans, you know, but certainly not from Manchester United fans. And it's an obvious question to ask, but I have to ask, Michael, favourite goalkeeping gaffe?
My favourite goalkeeping gaffe,
or a memorable one, because maybe not favourite perhaps.
I mean, it's not one that's a massive mistake, but it's the kind of classic when Shea Given had the ball against Coventry and he rolled it out and Dion Dublin ran around him almost from the stands to poke the goal. It was just sounded like a classic comedy area. It could kind of happen to most goalkeepers.
Was he a bit unlucky, because didn't Dion Dublin stay off the pitch?
Yes.
And actually should have probably been called up on that.
Well, it was, I think a cross had just come in towards the back post.
Yeah.
And I think, it was a free kick, wasn't it? Given was taking. And a lot of players had gone up for it. And Dublin's momentum had carried him off the pitch. Right, it wasn't like he'd sort of, crept off surreptitiously.
But he didn't have to sort of sit in the front row and have to read the paper for a couple of minutes and then, whatever he did.
You're not allowed to leave the field, true, are you? Yeah. So I don't know, maybe he should have been pulled up on it.
But the best thing was, because that wouldn't have worked had that been an away game, because the crowd would have told Given that he was there, but instead Highfield Road sits there, sees exactly what's going to happen, and there must have been a little, oh, hang on, what's Dion doing? And the funny thing, you watch it, I saw it again recently, Given doesn't even react. Yeah. There have been a few of those. Robbie Keane scored one. I forget who the goalkeeper was. Goalkeeper rolls it out and Robbie Keane just darts in from behind him. Keeper panics. Given doesn't even move. He's just so totally stunned to see, Dion Dublin come round the corner. And
that doesn't count, surely. Yeah. Tom, a favourite gaffe you can think of off the top of your head?
I'm going to go for one. It's not an obvious one because it didn't result in a goal, but the Roy Carroll, Pedro Mendes gaffe. When he spilt that speculative halfway line punt from Pedro Mendes over the line. And obviously we remember that now for the fact that the goal was not given, despite the ball being a yard behind the line. Mm-hmm. But if you focus on the error itself, it is a preposterous error.
Oh, it's a shocker.
I mean, Carroll's come out to clear a ball outside his box. Okay, maybe he's disorientated. Yeah. I'll give him that. But by the time the ball is dropping out of the sky towards him, he's back in position. It arrives at chest height. It should be one of the most comfortable saves he's ever made.
His positioning was very
positioning,
good.
You couldn't fault his position. And somehow, a ball that should be an easy chest height catch somehow ends up in the net. Like, absolutely extraordinary.
It's hard to catch a ball behind you like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite incredible.
He could have chested it down.
Yeah.
He could have taken a touch.
He could have done a scorpion kick.
All the time in the world.
Yeah.
And somehow shoveled it into his own net. And I think had he not got away with it, I think we'd remember that as the greatest goalkeeping gaffe of the Premier League era.
Yeah.
The Man United goalkeeper basically throwing one in from like a 50-yard punt. I mean, extraordinary save.
But then it goes down as a great recovery save, technically speaking.
Well, the funniest thing as well is he swipes and he has two little guilty looks at the linesman.
Oh, he
knew. Like one, two. Oh, I've got away with that. Okay.
Yeah.
Come on, lads.
That's it.
Because he was lucky the linesman was miles away, wasn't he? He was 50, on the halfway line or whatever.
Yeah, my goodness. As we go through the years of these Manchester United goalkeepers, and there's a few Arsenal goalkeepers, of course, came after David Seaman, the aforementioned Petr Cech stands out. And the next goalkeeping generation sort of arrived a little bit later, if you will. Petr Cech coming in at Chelsea and Pepe Reina at Liverpool, who was a decent keeper, very popular with the Liverpool fans, Michael. The best clean sheet per game records in Premier League history.
Yes, those two. Cech is number one and Reina's number two. Which...
That is quite... Because as I sort of looked at that, I almost didn't believe it.
Yeah, I think Cech is on 48% of games and Reina's on 46% of games. They kept a clean sheet, which I think to a certain extent reflects the fact they played under Mourinho and Benitez, who were managers who were quite defensive-minded and created a very solid back four. I mean, the funny thing about that is Cech's ratio is slightly dropping as he's moved to Arsenal. So Reina may overtake him despite not playing in the Premier League any longer.
Yeah.
But they were both great goalkeepers. Very different, I think. Cech was... probably a little bit old school. You wouldn't say he's particularly good with his feet or particularly good at sweeping, but just really solid. I mean,
reliable.
He came after Euro 2004 when he made a couple of fantastic saves for Czech Republic. Straight away, he kept 25 clean sheets in his first season with Chelsea.
That's right.
In 38 games, which is ridiculous.
Didn't he take the record or something, the amount of minutes without conceding?
I think he did, yeah, before Van der Sar then got it as well.
That's right.
And Reina was maybe, I guess, a more Spanish goalkeeper, literally, but in terms of style, he was better at sweeping. Again, he was very good with his throws a little bit, like Schmeichel. So they're very different in style again, but, you know, that was... after this kind of Manchester United and Arsenal problems with replacing the goalkeepers, Liverpool and Chelsea became, you know, that's when the big four started as well. And I think part of that was they had such solid goalkeepers.
Yeah, with Pepe Reina, Tom, I sort of think of him in a slightly similar bracket, someone like Fabian Barthez, good goalkeeper, agile, good distribution and all. But as Michael says, slightly erratic. And there was a couple of mistakes he made, I think, or certainly one away at Goodison Park in a derby. But has a sort of feel-good factor around him with, in terms of teammates. I mean, he's essentially Spain's cheerleader as well because he's the number three and never ever plays. Do you see what I mean by Pepe Reina? Perhaps you disagree.
No, completely. And I think that's how a lot of people in this country probably think about him. I mean, you sort of remember him at the 2010 World Cup and then, you know, I think the European Championship that followed. And he was sort of the chief cheerleader. There was that one where he tried to put a Barcelona shirt on Cesc Fabregas when they were all standing on stage somewhere. And, you know, clearly a very, very popular guy. I mean, I'm not sure you describe him as a great goalkeeper, would you? But certainly one of the best goalkeepers that the Premier League has seen. Another goalkeeper who was good with his feet at a time when it wasn't the absolute be-all and end-all for goalkeepers, as it increasingly seems to be.
Mm. Well, now it feels like there's a new generation as well, or a newer generation, a very strong set of goalkeepers in the Premier League. David De Gea is an obvious one. Courtois, Lloris as well. Who's your pick of the current crop, Tom?
They're very hard to separate, those three, I think. I think Lloris is a fantastic goalkeeper, and I think he interprets that role of the sweeper keeper better than anyone, certainly in England. He's not as physically imposing as someone like Courtois, who's a proper giant, but astonishing reflexes. I mean, some of the saves he's made this season, even. I watch Man United quite a lot, and De Gea is extraordinarily consistent. I mean, he makes the occasional error, but think about when he first arrived from Atletico Madrid. United had paid about 19 million, which I think at the time made him the world's second most expensive goalkeeper. He wasn't Spain's first choice, and he's this little willowy guy with a bum fluff moustache, and he looked very, you know, unsuited to English football, and there were, you know, a few mistakes in his first outings, and Alex Ferguson had to come out and defend him. But since then, I mean, he's extremely consistent, and you notice it less so now under Mourinho because United are a bit more solid, but certainly under Van Gaal and Moyes, he dug them out of so many. I remember once, I think they played at home to Brendan Rodgers Liverpool, and I can't remember the outcome actually.
Was it 3-0, I think?
It was the 3-0.
Yeah, and the difference was just the goalkeepers, wasn't it?
Yeah, and basically De Gea saved about five one-on-ones, all from Raheem Sterling.
Yeah,
that's right.
And there seemed to be no way past him.
And then at the other end, I think Mignolet made two quite bad errors, didn't he? Mm. So it was just decided upon that.
Yeah, De Gea is absolutely world class, Michael. Some of the saves he makes, we talked about positioning and all, and goalkeepers being worth their weight in gold when it comes to the points tally at the end of the season. But De Gea, you know, some of those saves he makes, I know it's a bit of a cliche thing, but it's almost as good as a goal, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think him and Courtois are both fantastic. Both came from Atletico, of course, and now they've got Oblak, incredible chain of goalkeepers
right,
they've had.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, I feel like by now Courtois should be better than De Gea, because I think Atletico, he was so good.
Yeah.
If you look at how young he is, I mean, he's still 23, 24, I think. But it seems like his form just dipped a little bit when he got to Chelsea. I gather he doesn't particularly like England. He preferred living in Madrid. I don't know if his concentration wavered a little bit, but I think De Gea is still the superior goalkeeper.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and De Gea, of course, nearly moved back to Madrid, didn't he? But then that shows his professionalism, because often when a player has his head turned in such a way and it is very close to moving, and some players then go on to kind of force a move through, it can derail what they're doing at their current club. But De Gea, you wouldn't say that was the case. But staying in Manchester with goalkeepers, at the start of the season, there was a lot of debate about goalkeeping styles. Pep Guardiola bringing in Claudio Bravo, of course, and loaning out Joe Hart. And it looks like there's no way back for Joe Hart. I mean, is Bravo the next dominant type of keeper, Michael? Well, he's not had a brilliant time so far.
No, it feels like Guardiola wants that goalkeeper to be the next dominant type of goalkeeper. I think Guardiola, to be honest, has been quite surprised by how many long balls there are in English football. And I mean, if you go back to that first game Bravo played in the Manchester Derby at Old Trafford, just an extraordinary performance. He played almost permanently 30 yards off his line as an extra centre-back. Yeah. Made a mistake for the goal when he dropped across. Mm. And then later in the game got tackled by, I think, Rooney. No, he got tackled by Ibrahimovic and then like two-footed Rooney. And it was almost like this parody of a sweeper-keeper performance. And then you look at his statistics later. I mean, in January and February, I think he went 7 shots on target without making a save.
Yeah.
And it really is, I mean, it's clearly what Guardiola wants, an 11th outfielder. Mm-hmm. But he's really taken it to the next level with not saving shots. It's just quite a bizarre situation.
It is. Tom, do you feel a little bit sorry for Joe Hart? I mean, he's Joe Hart, people, I think, especially England fans, wanted Hart to be a part of that list of the De Gea's and Courtois and so on. But he's not in that bracket, really, is he?
No, I don't think he's a million miles away from it,
sure.
But he's not. He's not an absolute top-ranked goalkeeper. He does have a mistake in him. And Guardiola clearly arrived at City, and one of the first things he clearly decided on this well before he arrived. And you look at, you know, when he went to Barcelona, perhaps to a lesser extent Bayern Munich, each of the clubs that he has coached, he has set out his objectives in terms of who he wants to move on, who he wants to retain very quickly. And I think part of it is about sending out a message. Joe Hart has been at Man City longer than any other players in that team, played in all their triumphs, clearly a very confident figure, a very important figure in the dressing room, someone who gets accused of arrogance from time to time. And you wonder whether part of Guardiola's thinking, I think the reason that Hart got shipped out is because he didn't match the technical specifications of the sort of goalkeeper that Guardiola wants to play with. But I wonder whether that aspect of Hart being this big character, you know, was a way for Guardiola to sort of say, well, look, he's bombed out. You know, this is how it's going to be from now on. But I do feel very sorry for Joe Hart. And you sort of wonder where his long-term future lies. He's not going to stay at Torino. I think he's had a bit of a mixed season. I mean, it's always great seeing British players go abroad, give it a go. You know, from what I can gather, he's trying his best with Italian. He seemed pretty popular with their fans. But he's not going to stay there, you know, longer than this season. And what sort of level should he be aiming at? Are another Champions League club going to come in for him? Or is he going to have to come back to England and, you know, and perhaps drop down a bit for one of those sort of Europa League level teams? And a pity for England as well, really, because you sort of thought, well, that's Joe Hart, Man City's first choice goalkeeper until his mid-30s. And suddenly, you know, that's been taken away from him. So it'd be interesting to see how he responds. And of course, now we've got young goalkeepers coming through. I mean, he was already under, there was competition, guys like Fraser Forster, and now we've got Jordan Pickford coming through at Sunderland, who looks a really, really exciting goalkeeper. So within the space of a few months, Joe Hart's future, both for club and country, you know, doesn't look quite so rosy as it did.
Indeed, yeah. Just a round off, Michael, of the various goalkeepers throughout the Premier League era, who would you say was the key revolutionary, the man who really took things forward and influenced future goalkeepers?
I think of everyone, it's got to be Schmeichel.
Yeah.
As Tom mentioned earlier, he made goalkeeping exciting. I think he was very revolutionary in terms of his distribution, in terms of being a leader as well. I mean, we forget that it wasn't until recently where people used to kind of laugh at the idea a goalkeeper could be a captain because they were all the way back there. But, you know, you look at Buffon and Casillas at international level, you don't really kind of take any notice of that now. And also, again, going up to score corners, it's just become part and parcel of goalkeepers' qualities late in a game now, and that was really something introduced by Schmeichel. So I think he is the game changer, really.
Yeah. And we got through a whole big chat on Premier League goalkeepers there throughout the history. Didn't mention David James once. So I thought I'd give him a little mention there, as he was as an ever-present throughout many Premier League years. Thanks very much for listening to the first episode of The Mixer podcast. Michael Cox's The Mixer, the story of Premier League tactics from Route 1 to False Nines, is out now in hardback, ebook and audiobook. I'm Marcus Speller. Thanks very much to Michael Cox and Tom Williams for joining me. Please join us next time when our attention turns to fullbacks.